Yep. Okay, so I take it you can all hear me in the back? So I guess this starts the more formal part of the program in the sense that this will be the first lecture in gene dynamics, aside from the introductions that Louise and Lars gave about the mineralogy of the transition zone and outstanding problems in sort of dynamics and perhaps geochemistry of the transition zone. So I took the liberty of listing a little bit of the geodynamics program. We've changed the order. So these are the initials of the participants. And you'll see that we all have three letters. Okay, I don't know. That's important to me for reasons I don't understand. So today, I wanted this to be very informal in the sense that I would like you to interrupt me. Is there something you don't understand? I'm not going to concentrate on the theory of how we are, how we do things, rather on the observations, mostly at the surface, that can help us understand mental dynamics, but also has a relationship to the transition zone. Now, I like Barbara said, this is on the web, but basically the way we're gonna go about this is giving you an introduction of the dynamical observations of the Earth from very global fields, like the gravity field, the heat flow, and so on, and plate motions, to, you know, other observations that perhaps you don't think about so much, like topography and sea level, and what relations do those have to the transition zone and mental dynamics. Then Peter will give an introduction also, you know, sort of the more basics of what present-day mental convection looks like. And from then on, we'll move on to, I'll give you later the theory and applications of how we go about modeling precise observations of the surface. Moving on to the thermal evolution of the Earth and thermochemical convection. And you'd see there a list of tutorials. Our first tutorials will be actually on Thursday, is that correct? And it will, you'll get to do some mental convection modeling with a finite element model and, you know, look at plumes and things like that. And then you'll actually get to do modeling of the geoid with some tomographic models and look at the viscosity structure and basically learn message number one, no matter what anyone tells you, the geoid cannot resolve anything but one jump in viscosity in the mantle. So don't believe anything else. Okay, there are two messages that I want you to take out of this lecture. And that is that related to the transition zone, even though all the geological and geophysical observations I will be showing you seem disparate and perhaps not connected, they're really all connected to mantle flow, number one. And therefore are really very connected to two things that are very important in the transition zone and unique about the transition zone. There's the fact there's the huge number of phase transitions in two components, the pyroxene garnet component and the olivine component, and the fact that the rheology is likely changing and the change in viscosity from upper mantle to lower mantle. So if there's one message and one recurring theme of the implications of what I'm going to show you is that phase transitions matter and the viscosity structure matters without necessarily showing you any modeling on those particular things. Okay, so here's a list by no means complete of observations that we can use. They're mostly surface observations to constrain the dynamics. Starting from the elements of plate tectonics, which you know, Barbara talked about at the beginning in the introduction to CIDR. So we'll hear you'll hear a little bit about that, following on the plate reconstructions and therefore the history of slabs in the mantle, and topography and heat flow, and also the, because topography means changing the distribution of mass at the surface, what that means for the gravity field and again viscosity structure. And I'm going to end with a specific regional observation of the gravity field and topography above subduction zones, which I hope will get picked up later on the convection lectures. Now, I've left a lot of things that are here. Obviously, I've left out, actually, I won't be talking about displacial rebound. I've left out two polar wonder, modeling of hotspots specifically and how they move in the mantle wind and so on. So this is just a smattering of observations that we can use. And obviously, we need to start with plate tectonics, a geodynamicist. You'll hear them say that again and again, or perhaps just me, that plate tectonics is the most fundamental surface expression of mantle convection, and that's certainly true. And we've understood that really since the beginning of when plate tectonics as a theory came about, both in its kinematic form and later with Oxford and Turka doing the boundary layer theory to show that indeed we could produce plate-like velocities on a heat flow distribution similar to that measure. So what I have here is a cartoon, obviously, of plate tectonics, and you're all familiar with that. But let's review a few tenets that are really important, because in the context of fluid dynamics, it's really important to understand that plates are weird and very difficult to treat. So the first is that we have plates that are largely rigid, move as a unit, move as a unit with a constant velocity for a long period of time, that most of the deformation happens at the boundaries, but not all the deformation, and that the top boundary layer, the top plate, is really the thermal boundary layer of the top of the mantle convecting system. So the plates and mantle are really one unit. With some difficulties arising from that, the fact is that continents, which have chemically distinct compositions, well, you know, that's very difficult to treat in the mantle convection model. Problem number one. Problem number two is that plate boundaries are false. They're long-lived and, you know, exhibit brittle failure, and therefore that's very difficult to treat in a fluid dynamical context. And number three, for example, is that subduction is asymmetric. But why is this all important in terms of the mantle dynamics? The reason is that every time you have something, you have a ridge, you're generating melt, and you're chemically differentiating the top thermal boundary layer. So not only are you generated a great deal of thermal heterogeneity as the mantle uprises here and then it cools down and subsides, but you're actually generating also geochemical, compositional, major element heterogeneity, which is then reintroduced back into the mantle. So you have the continuous generation of dynamical, thermal, and compositional heterogeneity, which of course is going to affect the structure of the mantle in a seismic sense and also in a geochemical sense. And how that reintroduction of the heterogeneity affects the mantle structure will depend critically on the plate tectonic observations at the surface, meaning what are the plates doing in terms of arranging themselves, and we'll see that in a second, and also how they interact with the transition zone, because the viscosity structure of the mantle, especially how it changes in the transition zone, and the phase transitions, well, that will affect what happens as they go down, or for that matter, the material as it comes up. The direct connection between plate tectonics and mantle convection in a fluid dynamical sense was made a long time ago, like I said at the beginning. And this very simple sort of cellular two-dimensional picture of convection, that this is a very famous cartoon by Turkan and Oxford in the Annual Reviews of Fluid Mechanics paper, and also Turkan and Schubert for that matter, the geodynamics textbook, where you have the semi, you know, sort of infinite in this direction. You have a layer of fluid that is heated from below, cooled from above. This layer will eventually go unstable and a hot plume will rise. It will impinge on the cold boundary layer and it'll start cooling down. And then, you know, as two of them, you know, join together, it'll actually go down. So you could think of this as upwellings and downwellings, and if you want, ridges and slabs. Except that the picture isn't that simple. For one, this is a symmetric subduction zone, right? And one of the things we just said is that that's not a characteristic of plate tectonics on Earth. Okay, so what makes it difficult? This picture, though, gives us a lot. It gives us the fact that largely, you know, with some of the exceptions because of the rheology is difficult, it gives us a plate that it's rigid and it's moving at a constant velocity with some problems, you know, sometimes it's stagnant and so on. It gives us a downwelling. It gives us heat flow observations that are pretty close to, you know, with some exceptions, what I'll talk about in a second. But what makes it difficult to relate to fluid dynamics? So fluid dynamics in the continuum limit, right, will have the behavior of things that do not have singularity in stresses and velocities. And instead, for plate motions, we have a piecewise continuous velocity field in space and time, which we'll see in a second, and very specific behavior, like the amount of toroidal motion, which I'll define in a second, that is very difficult to reproduce in a fluid dynamical system. So let's talk about the continuity in space and time, and I'll relate this to the transition zone in a second. At first, I want to give you just the basics here. This is a slide that I've probably shown, I don't know, 100 times in my life. Hopefully, I'll stop showing it soon. And what you have here is these are plate reconstructions from a period right after the bend in the Hawaiian Emperor Chain and right before the bend in the Hawaiian Emperor Chain, 43 to 48 million years and 25 to 43. And, you know, this is controversial now in that people say it didn't happen this way. It is the best known example. There are many other examples in the geological record, but so let's just take it at face value for right now. Well, piecewise continuity in space is just a fancy way of saying that there are plates, right? And that they are rigid units that move with a constant velocity and that they're separated by plate boundaries. And the space-wise continuity in time, but what that implies is that every time you have a plate boundary in a fluid dynamical field, you actually have a singularity in the velocity field, right? So that's a problem. In time, however, you see that the Pacific plate is sort of just happily going north, And then in a period that has been dated at less than a million years, it actually changes velocity by about 70 degrees. You know, trust me, that's hard to do in a mantle convection model. And it's hard to do in that period of time of 1 million years, and it suggests that what is controlling that is perhaps the strength of the lithosphere, and again, faults and brittle failure, not a characteristic of fluid dynamical models. So already we have an inherent limitation in being able to treat dynamically plates and mantle, and how do we do that, and therefore how do we learn more about the connection between them and how they're related to deep earth dynamics. Related to that, there are different types of plate boundaries. You know, I talked about ridges, I talked about subduction zones. The other thing, the thing I didn't talk about are these long features like this. This San Andreas you'll be familiar with, which is not here, obviously, started 30 million years or so ago. These are transform faults. Now, transform faults are peculiar features of the Earth. Actually, I'll talk about that in a second. So remember this, the fact that temporally and spatially this is difficult to do. Now let's review some of the characteristic kinematically of the observed velocities today, which is also hard to do without taking into account the specifics of the rheology of plates and how they interact with the mantle underneath. So these are the observed velocities for the present day, and these are actually, the arrows obviously give you the direction, the length of the arrow gives you the magnitude, so the speed at which the plates are going, and the speed at which the plates are going, if they're connected to the mantle, is going to be related to the absolute viscosity of the mantle, something to keep in mind. Now what you notice here is that these are color-coded, and they are color-coded by whether they're by this scale right here, where their velocity, their absolute velocity, is normalized by the average velocity of all plates. So the blue colors are things that are going very slowly, and red colors are things that are going very fast. So at first glance, what this looks like is an observation that comes from 1975 and perhaps earlier, but certainly, you know, most famously presented in the work of Forsyth and Ojeda, which is, as they describe it, that oceanic plates go fast and continental plates go slowly. Okay? If you actually look at that in detail, and that is it's important that you look at that in detail, it's not that oceanic plates go fast and continental plates go slowly. It's that plates that have slabs attached to them go fast, and plates that do not have slabs attached to them go slowly. Okay? And that's an important point to remember, because you'll be able to study that in some detail. Okay. So that's as far as the main velocities go, so something that has to be reproduced. Well, then let's talk about the transform faults. So, you know, what kinds of energy are available in the plate field that can tell us something about mantle dynamics and the behavior with which the mantle and the plates interact? So one way to do this, and, you know, this goes way back, actually, to Kaola and even before, is to correct the plate velocity field at the surface into two parts. What is the component that is related to the divergence of the field, the horizontal divergence of the field, and the other, the radial vorticity, okay? So one thing to think about is, you know, things that are upwelling and diverging, or things that are converging and, you know, going down and downwelling. So the divergence field up here, these are pictures from a paper by Dumoulin and of Dave Bercovici. You see here where there are the areas, and this is all along the plate boundaries, where you get most of the divergence field and most of the vorticity field. Okay, and I'll explain the vorticity field in a second. So you see, obviously, that you have it strongly, a negative divergence at subduction zone and strong positive divergence at ridges. Okay, well, so that makes a lot of sense. Okay. Now, the vorticity field, the radial vorticity, think of that as just a shear field, you know, sort of like eddies in an ocean and so on. That is associated with transform faults. And what you see is that there's a strong vorticity field, again, associated with the Pacific and associated with some of the interoceanic or interridge transforms, but also with the San Andreas Fault. But most importantly, with oblique subduction. By far, the most important component of vorticity for the plate velocity field of the Earth is in the oblique subduction in the Aleutians and the oblique subduction north of the New Hebrides. Okay, so why does that matter? Why do we care? We've had this observation for a long time. Well, if you had a homogeneous convecting fluid, you'd actually generate absolutely zero vorticity. Okay? You generate no toroidal power whatsoever. So it's really the presence of plates and of lateral viscosity variations associated with plates that give you the toroidal field. But why should you have a toroidal field at all? Right? Toroidal field does not dissipate any heat. So why should you have transforms at all? is it a geometric requirement of the Earth? Well, you know, probably it is. But there are some deeper reasons there. I mean, like the presence of plates. But so it remains a little bit of, you know, would say a little bit of a mystery as to why there is so much toroidal power in the Earth, because it does very little for you in terms of, you know, making the heat engine go. Okay. The other important thing about understanding the divergence and vorticity field, or as we call them other times, poloidal and toroidal, is that the ratio of the poloidal to toroidal power has been used as a characteristic to say that in a mantle convection model you've achieved plateness or you have not achieved plateness, meaning that you have a model with such a rheology at the surface that it's giving you a plate with a constant velocity which then drops off when you get to the boundaries. Okay. Now, I'll argue, actually, without going into a lot of detail, that that's not a good measure because most of it is concentrating in the Pacific. And because, in fact, this is the velocity as a function of time for the last 120 million years. This is basically the divergence field, and this is the vorticity field. This doesn't change very much. This has changed a great deal, and maybe that says something about the nature of plate driving forces. But because most of the toroidal power is in the Pacific Basin, related to oblique subduction is really not a good measure of the characteristics of a plate. And so I hope that people move away from that eventually. Okay? It is also not equipartitioned, which is means that there's actually much more divergent power than toroid, than vorticity power, which therefore means that certain models of, you know, making plates are not correct. Okay. Now, I just want to recap this. I won't be doing this, of recapping every observation, but in this case, because these are sort of disparate observations, I want to recap the implications of the plate kinematic observations for some of the dynamical things that we're worried about here. In terms of the sort of what is a plate and how you make plates, is very important to understand you know, the characteristics of the kinematics. The connection to the mantle convection, and I'll show you this in a second, is that the structure of the historical structure of the tectonic field is going to affect the scale of heterogeneity that you're able to observe and therefore aid in the interpretation of seismic tomography. And also that the viscosity structure, both the radial and geographical variability, will be very important in terms of understanding how the plate and mantle are coupled, how that varies geographically, the strength of slabs, and perhaps deep earthquakes, which I'll show in a second. Okay, so let me show you a few of these things. The first is related to how to make a plate. This is a figure from a very nice review paper in EPSL by Dave Vercovici, in which he sets up a very, very simple sort of conceptual model where he has a sink and he has a source for the flow. So material is upwelling here and downwelling there, okay? And then he's plotted in these panels right here, he's plotted the velocity, the horizontal velocity. He's plotted the vorticity field, again, thinking about this toroidal power and the ability to make transforms in a fluid dynamical sense. And here he's plotted you know, some either temperature or volatility that defines the rheology of the system. So it's a system in which either temperature for temperature-dependent viscosity or volatiles are determining the rheology. Okay, so here's the horizontal velocity here, the vorticity, and so on. And what's to note here? Okay, what's to note is that if you use sort of a standard temperature-dependent viscosity, say at the top, and here instead you use the something that's a power law rheology, a very not certainly very non-Newtonian, but one that has yields at a certain stress level and then rapidly drops down, or it's very weak as the deformation goes up. Now, what you see here with a standard temperature-dependent viscosity in the sink and source and sink model is that actually the deformation, as characterized by the vorticity, is very broad in the plate. It certainly does not resemble most of our ideas about how plates move. And you can see also, you know, the concentration of the, you know, where most of the temperature is changing and so on. On the other hand, if you use some sort of power law rheology or some, you know, exotic rheology, I'll call it, even though that's not completely fair, you actually get a localization of the deformation so that you get true transforms, you know, right lateral and left lateral. And then you can also see how the sort of the damage is concentrated in certain areas so that the volatile or whatever that volatility content is concentrated in certain areas. So that we've made some progress, you know, because of the observations and the kinematics that we had and the connection to the mantle of understanding sort of from first principles how you make plates in a fluid dynamical system. But, you know, we're not quite there yet. Now, in terms of how plates move as a function of time and their effect on mental heterogeneity, I've borrowed here liberally from some websites. This is a work by Peter Bunga and Steve Grand. And up here, this are three-dimensional simulations of mental convection. Actually, I don't think they include phase transitions, and certainly don't include compositional effects. What you see here, these are the plate boundaries at the top. These are some isotherm chosen to show the cold material and to show the hot material, and that's the core over there. To orient to, this is actually the Pacific plate right here. Okay, see that's South America, that's sort of the region around Kamchatka and so on. And in this particular calculation, they've imposed a series of plate reconstructions for the last 120 million years, so it's not surprising that the downwellings are actually, correspond to the plate boundaries at the surface. Okay, so you see very clearly that there's a connection between the plate tectonics and their introduction of that heterogeneity into the structure of the mantle. But the specifics of how that heterogeneity is distributed, like Louise was showing in some figures, where the slabs are going to pond in the transition zone or not, depend very critically on the viscosity structure that you choose and how you treat the phase transition. So that remains, to a certain extent, an unresolved problem, because it's certainly in three dimensions, there are no models that include all the phase transitions that are necessary to describe the transition zone. Because that it is so important to have sort of the right rheology and the right connection with the other elements of the mantle structure that affect the dynamics, you really need to think a little bit beyond about what plates are and trying to a certain extent to say, okay, maybe I can't do the three-dimensional problem with all the phase transitions and the right rheology. Perhaps I can abstract myself a second and make much simpler models, which is what you've been learning on Friday, and say, are there observations that I can explain by losing sophistication but gaining predictive power? And so that's what I'm going to show you next, is the ability to take very simple models of mental flow and trying to predict surface observations and gain in sophistication by making very, very simple parametrizations that, say, take into account the rheology and hopefully at some point in the future, the effect of the phase transition. So one way to think about that and relate it to the heterogeneity that you saw in a second is that the heterogeneity that you saw, if it's related to the imposition of the plate motions at the surface and the tectonic history, means that it has to very critically to do with how the slabs drive the plate motions and how they interact with the mantle underneath. And moreover, so that the slabs are cold, they're going to come in here gravitationally, they're going to drive flow and so on. But what is the effect of the rheology? What is the effect of a strong slab or a weak slab or a detached versus non-detached slab on the plate motions? Okay, so the first thing that we can do is to make the simplest possible model of mantle flow and take some density heterogeneity field, whether it be from tomography or whether it be a model of subduction history, and say, let's compute the instantaneous flow, and I'll give you those details on Friday on how you do that, and let's compute what the surface velocity field would be for a specific density heterogeneity at the in the interior. So these are the observed velocities using that color scale you saw before, and this is one model where you only include one part of what's important for slabs. So this is what you need to remember. So this is, gravitationally, this is going to sink. It's going to induce flow in the entire mantle. We're going to call that induced mantle flow, we're going to call suction. But then we're going to try to come up with a proxy for the strength of the slab that will define whether the slab transmits all its weight back to the plate or there is actually is supported by the rest of the mantle. And we're going to call that slab pull. And so those are the terms that you're going to see come up. So if you only take into account slabs in their fluid dynamical limit, no elastic strength whatsoever, no strength to the slab whatsoever, and you only looked at the induced viscous flow, this is what you get. Okay, you get velocities that are more or less in the right direction, right? And that's because you've prescribed to a certain extent the directions by telling where the heterogeneity is, which is related to subduction. So you get a Pacific plate that it's going sort of northwest, and you get a North American plate that it's going towards the Pacific plate and so on. But you see that there are serious problems, right? This color scale does not resemble this color scale. In fact, all the plates here are largely going at the same velocity. Okay, so can we account for the rheology, and again, these two themes, phase transitions and rheology, and do a little better? Well, we can. We can say, okay, Let's say the slabs are strong, and let's say that all the slabs are attached, particularly in the upper mantle, and take the entire weight of the slab and say it does not induce viscous flow in the mantle right here. It only transmits its weight back to the plate. Okay? So this is an the version of slab pull that Forsyth and Ojeda really have in their paper. So we can do that. We can do for every subduction zone, there are 11 right here, we can characterize the weight of the slab, because looking down to see how many slabs have gone down in the last 120 million years, and sort of plot the pull force and see how that does as a function with predicting the plate velocities. I'll skip one side and say if you only use slab pull, you actually don't get things right. You have to have a combination of both, which is illustrated here, in which the upper mantle slabs are strong, and there's a weak upper mantle, and they transmit all their weight back to the plate. And the lower mantle slabs, and we're allowing for slab penetration into the lower mantle, which again will depend critically on both the rheology and the phase transitions here. The lower mantle slabs do induce flow, and those are responsible for really getting the continental plates moving in the right direction and at the right speed. Now, the connection to the viscosity structure of the mantle is, because this is all based on flow, what you assume for the radial viscosity structure of the mantle, what you assume for the lateral viscosity variations will very strongly influence, you know, what kinds of plate motions you can predict. And the absolute viscosity of the mantle, it's inversely proportional to the speed at which the plates go, right? So you have to make sure that you're within the bounds of the observations for the viscosity structure of the mantle. Okay. Now, one thing that we didn't consider in the previous picture, so this is the work really of Clint Conrad, is the fact that, okay, we said the slabs were strong and they were completely attached and able to transmit their force, but what if they're weak? Or what if they're detached at some level? What if they've been weakened by whatever mechanism that they've been weakened, you know, because of some deformation or whatever, and they're not able to transmit all their weight back? Or they're not, or they're completely detached. What are the effects of that? Well, you can actually try to do sort of an iterative procedure and see if it has an effect on plate motions. If you allow some of the slabs to pull at 100%, for example, here, or not, or actually not transmit any of their weight back or very little. And I'm not going to show you those results in particular, but just to say that clearly the strength of the slab, whether it's detached or in their ability to transmit stresses that act as a stress guide, impacts, should impact, the seismicity that you observe, and therefore have a connection to deep seismicity. Or at least I'm going to make the case that it does. And this is a paper with Sue Billick, in which we actually looked at the moment release at the deep seismicity between 300 and 670 kilometers based on how these different subduction zones, the seismicity of these different subduction zones, and whether they transmitted that weight completely or not. And although these correlations are weak, you know, I will admit to the scatter, this is the forward model after all, you actually do see a correlation in the fact that a strong plate slab attachment, that is slabs that are not weak and that haven't detached completely, allows for more seismicity at depth. And so there is a connection between the rheology of the slab, its interaction with the transition zone, and the deep earthquake. Okay. So if there is a connection, then we need to examine a little bit, you know, what are the effects of the viscosity structure, other characteristics of the kinematic field at the surface, and perhaps the phase transitions on the slab morphology as a function of depth, and how they may be seen seismically. Okay. So this is you know, quite old work by Tao and O'Connell, but the idea here is to show what happens when a slab that is sinking into the mantle encounters a mantle whose viscosity is 10 times that of the upper mantle. Okay, and what you see here is that, you know, the slab is affected. There's a lot of deformation. There is thinning of the upper mantle, and there's a thickening of the lower mantle. So even with complete slab penetration and not any degree of ponding in the mantle due to phase transition or trench rollback or something like that, you get structures that are very different than you would expect from a simple sort of introduction of slabs into the mantle and sinking and sinking into the mantle. So it's clear that to interpret what we see from seismology or ideas of a slab deformation, we have to have some connection to the viscosity structure that we observe. Then this is in a paper by Ole Christensen, He looked at a couple of other things. He looked at the effects of the phase transition and also the effect of trench rollback, meaning the subduction zone, it's migrating away from the, say, present-day position of the subduction zone. And you see that the ponding, again into the transition zone, will be related to the degree of trench rollback at the surface. If you have a, you know, very little trench rollback, you know, a ratio of only 20%, less than 20%, you would actually get complete penetration and no ponding. If the trench rollback is very strong, so you know, a ratio of 3 centimeters to 5 centimeters, then you get complete ponding. And as you know, there's more trench rollback, eventually things will go back down. They'll be gravitationally unstable. Also, the effects of phase transition, depending on the Clapeyron slope that you have, or the effect of a Clapeyron slope you may have, whether it's only the olivine transitions and the transitions in the pyroxene garnet, will also affect very strongly the structure of the slab, the ponding and the transition zone, and what you may observe in terms of a thickening of the slab as you go down. Okay, now, to be able to connect sort of these modeling exercises with the observations that we saw before, it's clear that we need to understand something about the history of plate motion, because trench rollback is a temporal feature that you know you can measure if you know the plate reconstructions, and also you know the, how plate boundaries migrate through time and subduction zones get generated and so on will affect where this heterogeneity is going into the mantle. So our most important observation that we have at the surface to be able to reconstruct plate motion is to use magnetic anomalies. Sort of illustrated here, this is as a function of age, the plate boundaries are superposed on top. And you can see by the changes in the geometry of the magnetic anomalies as they're generated in the ocean that in fact the plate geometry has changed a great deal. Illustrated best by this triangle, where in fact the structure and the number of plates in the Pacific plate back around 80 million years is, you know, a factor of 4 greater than today, since there were 4 plates instead of 1. Again, not counting Nazca and so on. So that's illustrated there. So how can we use this in a dynamical sense? Well, we need some way of reconstructing the velocities and the plate boundaries as a function of time. These are actually reconstruction from 10 million years ago to 64 million years ago, and really going back further than 80 million years is very dicey because the record essentially goes away. And you need some record of the plate velocities, obviously very uncertain, and therefore any predictions that you make based on this are going to be subject to the uncertainty of the plate reconstructions and the models of the plate velocities. But what you can see some very dramatic things. Even 10 million years ago, it was very different, the structure of the plates in the Pacific Basin, a Nazca plate that was much thinner. And as you go back in time, you see that this plate right here actually grows into one single plate, that's the Farallon plate, you know, upon which people have drawn to explain some of the seismic anomalies that they see in the mantle. And so, obviously, things have changed a lot. There's been a lot of stability, however, in the Pacific Basin in terms that subduction has been in sort of this circum-Pacific ring. We're perhaps going back around 80 million years, you perhaps get a subduction zone right here between different plates. Okay. The things that have changed and have to be explained by the dynamical model is the fact that the total subduction length has changed as a function of time. That might be just a consequence of not having the record and missing some of the intraoceanic subduction zones. The average subducting age has decreased with time. Actually, that's not just loss of record. If things are moving faster in the past, as they do seem to be moving faster in the past, you will get younger oceans and therefore younger material at subduction zones. We should change you know, the observations that you see in terms of the topography and the effects on the topography. So how to use this and use it to perhaps understand a little bit more about what we see in both regional and global models of tomography or images of slab. You know, one of the things that we did, again on a slide that I've also shown 100 times and hope to stop showing at some point, is to construct a model based on tectonics and say, I don't know anything else about the mantle except this. The top thermal boundary layer is extremely important because it's a system that is perhaps largely internally heated. It is continuously reintroducing thermal heterogeneity into the mantle. And if I account for where slabs have gone based on the position of subduction zones and their convergence velocity, I can make a model of just the subduction heterogeneity in the mantle. Okay. And so what are some of the assumptions of that model? Is that you're dropping, you have slabs in a fluid dynamical limit, so there's no coherence to the slabs. They're really Stokes bloblets going down. They're dropping in the upper mantle at a terminal velocity equal to their convergence rate. When they encounter the 660 kilometers depth, they're actually deflected because there is a viscosity contrast between upper and lower mantle that is a factor of 50, which translates into a slowing factor of about 4. Okay? Here, the only the information you get from tectonics is the position of the trench in the Hotspur reference frame and the convergence velocity, which you calculate from a global set of absolute velocities. Okay. And now we plot here just the relative density, you know, assume a relative density between this material, which is a function of age, and the rest of the mantle, and you actually plot it as a function of depth. And what do you see? The details really aren't important. The uncertainties, you know, this is a model, it's Fricke harmonic degree 20, so that's wavelengths of, you know, 2,000 kilometers or so on. The details are going to vary because they'll depend on the tectonic reconstructions themselves. But what the one thing to get out of this is that obviously whether subduction is happening and it has been long-lived, the structure, the temporal evolution of plate motions is reflected in the heterogeneity that you see at depth. Because allowing for slabs that penetrate into the lower mantle, the bottommost part of the mantle, and even somewhere around 1,000 kilometers, 1,500 kilometers, and so on, is dominated by the subduction that occurred in the north of the Pacific Basin, while the upper mantle is dominated by the western Pacific subduction, okay? So the temporal, you know, so you really, you could think that combining sort of the geodynamics with the seismology, you could get a picture of the tectonic evolution just because of the location of the slabs. And these techniques have been used to great effect. These are some of the initial observations for anomalies. For the Farallon slab, this is a picture from one of Steve Grand's very early papers. This is the GSA Today paper by Steve Grand and Rob Vanderhills comparing two different models. And, you know, this anomaly that they get, you know, which is largely, it's across North America and interpreted as that Farallon plate. But again, how you interpret exactly depends on those two characteristics, the viscosity structure and the phase transition. And then later on, this has been done by several people. This is one of the most recent by André Plumaz and Paul Taponier and Rob Vanderhills. And what you see here is the combination of the tomography with some tectonic models of the area and how complicated the structure of the possible slab is in Indonesia and how that's related to the very complicated tectonic of the region. And this is work by Rob Vandervoel looking at very, very old subduction, as a matter of fact, the late Jurassic and the early Cretaceous. So, you know, before 80 million years. Okay, now. So just to illustrate a little bit more, the effect of the changes in the plate motion and the dynamics, these are actually calculations by Tan et Tan, who's here in 2004, at the CIDR workshop for North America, and looking at the effects of the splitting of the Farallon plate into two plates and what effect that has on the structure of the slab that they may see under North America. And while the details, again, are not important, the fact is that it's actually very difficult to get a slab that doesn't, you know, sort of stick to the overriding plate. And this, the dynamics are very dependent on the viscosity structure right above the slab. They're dependent on the interaction with the phase transitions. And whether they detach or not is also dependent on the interaction with that viscosity structure and the phase transitions, to the point of getting something, perhaps, that looks extremely complicated with a slab that has sort of pondered on the core mantle band that are also thickened across the transition zone. Okay, now as slabs go down, so we're going to change gears a little bit here, but one of the characteristics that you're going to have, because this is a slab going down in a viscous mantle, is you're going to generate some flow, as we showed before, and that flow is going to generate radial stresses. Those radial stresses are going to impinge on the surface and are going to bring it down, so they're going to cause a redistribution of mass at the surface. They're going to induce topography, dynamic topography at the surface. So let's change gears a little bit and talk about the topography and bathymetry as we observe them at the surface. So this is a picture, this is actually topo 5, so it's actually quite out of date, of the topography of continents and oceans. And so what are the things we know about the contributions to topography? Well, we know the thickness of the crust is going to be very important, and that's why you have mountains that are elevated with respect to the surroundings. And although I'm not going to talk about it, the isostatic balance of crust is not trivial to calculate to see what are the contributions to the topography. One of the most obvious features, however, particularly for the oceans, as you can see here, is the specific rise. And so here you can see the yellows are high and the blues are low, is that the bathymetry actually gets deeper with age, you know, very well-known result. And so that's a subsidence as a function of age that we can relate to a very simple model. So here is, you know, this very simple model where we have a lithosphere that is rigid and moving away. This is half a ridge system, moving away from the ridge at a constant velocity. Okay, and the material is getting replenished here by the asthenosphere. There's no heat flux input from the bottom, right here. And we end up with essentially a one-dimensional heat conduction problem in a semi-infinite half space. And we end up with the thickness of a boundary layer that is proportional to the square root of age, or time that has elapsed. Okay, and then we end up, we can also look at the heat flow, and it's related heat flow, and we end up with a heat flow which is proportional to 1 over, essentially, the square root of age because of the thickness of the boundary layer here. And so if we have this very simple idea about what's happening in a ridge and as it moves away and it's cooling down, you know, what it should do, we can look at the observations of heat flow that we have, the global heat flow observations, and also the global observations from the bathymetry. So these are very simple pictures, actually, from Turcotte and Schubert. This is as a function of depth right here. These are different isotherms. And these, on top of that, are data for the thicknesses in the Pacific plate. Okay, so these are very old, and we'll look at a more updated version of this. And what do we find? We find that, you know, there's some scatter. You know, there's certainly a base of the lithosphere that is defined in terms of thickness by, you know, this very simple model, but that there are some deviations. And those deviations are best seen in this picture of the heat flow as a function of age away from the ridge. And so this is the model, the half-space cooling model in the black. And you see that before 40 million years, they're actually the observations, which are these with the one sigma standard deviation, these circles. It's actually cooler than the prediction. And actually, above about 70 million years, they're actually hotter than the prediction. So what's going on? The absolute level of the heat flow? Sorry. Well, I think assuming some surface temperature, you know, some difference between the surface temperature and the temperature of the mantle, some assumption. This, I mean, the differences between these two? Well, the typical explanation for why it's colder here is due to hydrothermal circulation, but... Well, we'll talk about that in a second. So in this half-space cooling model, the thickness of the lithosphere, as you can see from this, right, is going to be continuously increasing with age. And yet the observation is it actually starts flattening it out in 70 million years. These are observations from the Pacific, but this is actually true for both the Pacific and the Atlantic Ocean. It looks like the thickness is getting bigger. I agree, there's, you know, yes. The depth, as you will see in a second, this is very old, right? And so I don't know what the error bars are. But you'll see in the depth profiles in a second with all the latest data that actually it also gets shallow. Yes, sir. Yeah, so it's... And from a long time ago. Yeah, but I'll say this. Actually, I'm a big fan of the half-space cooling model as opposed to the plate model, and a fan of the reasons why you might have flattening. And actually, I think even in Yaron Ekstrom's, some of his Rayleigh wave, some of his surface wave models, he does see a continuing increase. You know, you still have to interpret it, but he does see it. So, you know, it's a fair point that there's some discrepancy in that observation. But the conventional wisdom is that, you know, these are colder because of hydrothermal circulation near the ridge, and that these are actually hotter because either there's rejuvenation, which I'll talk about in a second, or there's secondary convection. So either it has been rejuvenated by, say, putting in a bunch of hot spots that are making things cool. And you can certainly see in the Western Pacific that, you know, there's a lot going on, right? Another possibility that a lot of people have talked about is sort of secondary convection, sort of Richter rolls, sort of confined to very shallow depths, that it's giving you the higher bathymetry here, and therefore the higher heat flow as well. Or an input of some basal heat flux that it's not defined, which is some of the models of loose fluid too, and so on. I just wanted to show in a global sense what the heat flow looks like. Check out the time. This is a strict harmonic expansion of, you know, point-wise data. So there's a lot more data compared to what I showed you before, and this is the latest, actually, you know, it's more than this 93. You know, obviously it's high over ridges. There is a variation as a function of age that we pointed out before. And this is the latest model by, you know, Stein and Stein in terms of trying to understand both the heat flow and the bathymetric deviation. So let's see, the data are these dots right here. This is actually for the Western Pacific only. I don't think it's the global data set. And the solid line is the plate model, which is going to pass through these data right here. This envelope is a 1 sigma standard deviation. The dashed line, or the short dashed line, I think it's very hard to distinguish, is the Parsons-Claytor plate model, where you have a flattening at a given age, usually about 90 million years, where things tend toward that flattening. And then the plate model of Stein and Stein is this one here. Half-space cooling should be the long dashes, which, you know, I really can't see. So this is in terms of the heat flow. Obviously, better fit by assuming something that is flattening as a function of age. And this is the depth, or the, you know, the bathymetric differences, again, with the one standard deviation. And what you see, so depth is actually a lot easier to measure than thickness, right, which requires a lot of interpretation, what the thickness may be. And so that is the half-space cooling model, which would predict a lot deeper depths right here. This is the Parsons-Claytor model, and this is the plate model, which is slightly more complicated. Okay? Okay. So, you know, I mentioned this before, but, you know, to make a connection at sort of the at the global level, other reasons why you have contributions to topography, and sort of to try to connect all this sort of disparate dynamical observations into one picture that is related to the flow structure in the mantle, is that we can look at one part of the contribution to topography, which I've already mentioned. Besides the isostatic balance of crust, the thickness of the crust, the short uncompensated topography due to orogenesis, you actually also have very long wavelength topography that is due to dynamics, right, to those radial stresses that are either warping the surface down or up, okay? And that is what we know as dynamic topography. And can we see a contribution from dynamic topography, actually, on the topographic field? Well, as a caveat, let me mention that that's very difficult to do. You take that e-topo 5 or e-topo 30, whatever you want, and then try to take out the isostatic signal. But that isostatic signal depends on knowing the thickness of the crust very well and the composition and therefore density structure of the crust and the lithospheric mantle. That's also very difficult to do. So in fact, you know, when you hear observed dynamic topography, that's really a model of what the dynamic topography might look like, because it's a model of the isostatic contribution to the crust. Nonetheless, we can try to look at the contribution from dynamic topography, because it's very simply extracted from dynamical models. Because it's related to the radial stresses in the flow, the actual deflection from, say, an upwelling mantle is proportional to the magnitude of the radial stresses and inversely proportional to the inherent bulk compositional density difference between that mantle and the layer above, or that layer and the layer above. So, for example, crust and air, crust and water, and the gravitational acceleration. So you can actually calculate that deflection. So you get a model of instantaneous flow model, and we'll see how you can get the radial stresses out of that and plot a dynamic topography that is related to that density heterogeneity and viscosity structure that you've used. So do we have any evidence, actually, that there is a dynamic contribution to topography? I mean, it has to exist. The question is there any other surface that you can actually observe? Or is this all hidden inside the mantle? And why does that matter to us? If, for example, the 660 kilometer discontinuity is a compositional discontinuity, you can generate a great deal of topography at 660 and hide it from the surface. In terms of the geoid or dynamic topography contributions, we could care less, because that topography is there, it's contributing to the geoid, as we'll see in a second, but we can't see it at the surface. Okay. So I'll say this, because I want to relate it to something at the end, is that dynamic topography with the caveat of it's a model, the observations, is incredibly hard to observe. And there is no incontrovertible evidence of dynamic topography of our subduction zones that it's large enough, okay? In fact, you know, for any observations of dynamic topography of our subduction zones that is large, people say, oh yes, there's a contribution. Someone redoes the analysis of all the sediments and all the tectonic history and say, no, there's nothing to be seen. Now there are two, and you know, okay, so being modest, they're both mine, but there are two, I think, in my opinion, incontrovertible observations of dynamic topography. One is over Africa and the other is over the North Atlantic. And keep those two things in mind because both are regions where there hasn't been a lot of subduction, which we can then relate back to the differences in plumes and slabs and how they interact with the transition zone, or at least I'll make the case. Okay, so it is shown here on the left, this is a nonlinear scale. On the left is a residual topography, and this is Europe right here, this is North America. And you can see that, and so the reds are high and the blues are low. What you can see is there is an east-west difference in topography, right? So that over here is shallower over the oceans. This is, of course, corrected for age. So this is the residual topography corrected for age. And over here is deeper. So if you think back to the tectonic reconstructions and the fact that, you know, there's been the subduction of the Farallon over North America for a long time, and that Farallon plate and that anomaly has been seen over here, it's not surprising that it should be deeper on this side than this side, because the Farallon plate over here will bring the entire continent of North America down. Okay? And in fact, you know, this is the tomographic model of Jeroen-Ritsema. And you calculate the flow right here, and you can see, you know, it's going down where there are blues, which are interpreting as dense, and up where there are reds, and you're interpreting as hot. And then over here is the dynamic topography as you've calculated. And this actually, I can't remember exactly, this might be two different tomographic models. But if you can still see, of course, the wavelengths are you know, a lot greater. We're doing, you know, spherical harmonic degree 20, wavelengths of around 2,000. But you can see here, this is the outline of North America, this is the outline of Europe. And you would predict, because of the presence of the Farallon plate or of an anomaly that can be interpreted as a Farallon plate, that indeed sort of the eastern part of the North Atlantic would be shallower than the western part of the North Atlantic. So, of course, depends on viscosity structure. There's probably a nicer way to show this. This is the east-west depth difference as a function of seafloor age. And so this is the residual seafloor in the solid line. And then we have two different tomographic models, one which is only degree 20. The other one is, you know, would be, I don't know, closer to degree very high, whatever, 200. And you can see that, you know, they both see an east-west difference, but they don't capture all the short wavelength variation. Again, not unexpected, even, you know, calculating the effects of sediment compaction and so on. But these lines depend critically on that viscosity structure that you assume, and they change very much depending on what you do in terms of transition zone viscosity. Yes? What does that mean? Well, so an instantaneous flow calculation is, you know, it's an analytical solution for a spherical shell in 3D. Now, what are the shortcomings? One, you're doing very, you know, relatively low degrees, okay? I don't think you're going to have any numerical issues per se, but you're doing very low degrees, so long wavelength. And then your other problem, the robustness comes in, and we'll, you know, talk about this on Friday and also through the course of the meeting, is how you convert velocity anomalies to density to drive the flow, when some of it might be thermal and some of it might be compositional. So in that sense, they're not robust at all. Lars showed you this morning this DVS-DT, for example, that includes the effects of phase transition. And first, you know, it decreases without the effect of phase transitions a lot in the mantle. And with the effect of phase transition, especially in the upper mantle, you know, who knows? So in that sense, I'd say they're not robust at all. So is it the flow field of the mantle? No, but we can only judge its ability to capture something of the gross structure of the flow field in the mantle by comparison to observations at the surface. Okay. So globally, observed dynamic topography, this is actually work of Nico de Coker, a paper he's just submitted. And these are, after, you know, making a model of that isostatic contribution, what does observed, unquote, dynamic topography look like? And this is just to, you know, make the point, the larger point, that in fact over subduction zones you might not have a lot of residual topography, and perhaps over what is seen in seismic models as regions of low velocity, like Africa, persistent regions of low velocity in every model since Adam's first models, you know, the Pacific and Africa, that in fact you have, you know, quite a bit of amplitude, and, you know, perhaps here in the North Atlantic, quite a bit of amplitude of the residual topography. So how does this connect to my point about the phase transitions and so on? I would say that because the evidence that we have in terms of comparing the observation of the residual topography at the regional scale with mantle flow models is that we only see them really in areas where we're, you know, kind of confident that there should be upwellings, that perhaps what we're seeing is the different effect of phase transitions on plumes and slabs. That because the phase transitions and the capital slope of the phase transition are going to be temperature dependent, that there are going to be different phase assemblages and therefore different effects on the density when a slab goes down, that when a plume comes up. As a result, you might be able to transfer material more easily, say, and get a signal in terms of the radial stresses at the surface that you would with a slab that is ponding because of the phase transitions acting on them and impeding the flow. So that's one of my connections between dynamic topography and the structure of the transition zone. Now let's think, you know, at something else entirely. If you warp the surface due to dynamic topography, if you change the topography at the surface, you're actually also going to change the relative sea level. If you're changing the plate motion history, if you're initiating new subduction zones, if you have areas of long-lived subduction and plates migrating over areas that have long-lived subduction, you're going to have areas where the continents are going to grow over very sort of depressions, and then we're going to go over swells. So the history of subduction and the dynamic topography that it generates, it's going to be related to the record of continental flooding. And so this is another piece of geological evidence that perhaps you may be able to use with all the caveats that it entails. But, you know, trying to come up with a self-consistent model where you're using always the same density, heterogeneity, viscosity, structure, and assumptions, and that can explain a variety of observations. So this is one example of something that works only a little bit. So this is a bit of a fuzzy figure, but this is the predicted present-day dynamic topography given that slab model that I showed you several slides ago. And what we did, this was Mike Gernis and I, we chose continentally stable areas in South America, North America, Australia, India, and then in Indonesia. And then we calculated the differential dynamic topography between 64 million years ago and today, and, you know, as a function of time. And we plotted here the differential height as a function of age. And we also plotted the record, the sedimentary record, which can only be a minimal record of inundation, of continental flooding. Okay? And this is for the different continents. And so what do you see? You see, this is a very big problem, and a problem that goes back to whether there's a difference between slabs and plumes and in the expression of dynamic topography at the surface and the viscosity structure and so on, that by and large, our predictions are greatly larger than the sedimentary record, right? We're predicting a North American inundation by many more hundreds of meters than the interior seaway of the Cretaceous would have predicted. In Australia, we're a little bit closer, but we, you know, obviously we have something wrong because there's a phase like there. Nothing for South America. India should have had a huge deal of inundation due to, you know, the fast motion and all the dynamic topography generated by the subduction there, and yet you don't see it. So the record, obviously, dynamic topography is telling you something fundamental about the, you know, what we don't know about how the mantle flows. And why is this a big deal? Okay, I'm actually going to skip this. Yes. Yeah. So the predictions is the red, and the sedimentary thickness is the gray. So, you know, so for example, the average North American inundation, you know, would have been, you know, there were 50 meters or so. This is 500 meters here. And then, you know, the epirogenic seas in the Cretaceous would have been, you know, maybe as much as this. Yeah, so this is corrected for that. So all of these are corrected for sediment compaction and loading. Yeah, so well, you know, all these are sort of the thicknesses that you would, you know, the sort of sedimentary record of inundation after taking into account all the surface effects. And similarly, we did that for the North Atlantic as well as the effect of compaction as well. Okay, now changing the topography means you're changing the mass distribution at the surface, right? So you bring the surface down and you're now replacing earth with water if you're in an ocean or air. Bring the surface up, you're now replacing water with earth, with solid earth. What that means, if you're changing the surface distribution of, you know, the surface distribution of mass, is that you're going to affect the gravitational potential of the earth, or you're going to affect the geoid, the shape of the earth. The geoid is, you know, this reference surface that sort of defines sea level, at least for the oceans. And most of the signal that you see in the in the potential field of the Earth is due to the rotation of the fluid, is the hydrostatic potential. You take that out, and you're left with a distribution of anomalies, which is shown here for degrees 2 to 15, which is due to mass anomalies distributed inside the Earth, right? So you have some mass anomaly inside the Earth that is going to generate, you know, some, you know, there's going to be a gravitational attraction due to that. Okay. Now, the big insight in the 80s from, you know, Richardson Hager and Ricard et al. And others was to realize that because the mantle is dynamic, that you couldn't explain the geoid only by looking at the gravitational attraction of, you know, these dense masses or light masses. Well, you actually also had to account for the flow because of that redistribution of mass that happens when you have flow and therefore dynamic topography. So there are two big contributions to the geoid, and we'll explore this more in our tutorial on Friday as well as in the lecture. One is dynamic topography and the other is the geoid. Turns out dynamic topography is by far the most important contribution to the geoid. Okay? So it is important to know the flow structure to understand the geoid. It is important to know, because the flow structure is affected by viscosity, then the viscosity structure, both the radial and lateral viscosity structure, is going to affect the geoid at the surface. So one of the ways in which we've tried to understand the viscosity structure of the Earth, how it varies as a function of depth, is to, and this is really with the advent of seismic tomography, so the first paper that really started doing this was in 1985, Brad Hager and others in Nature said, let's take a tomographic model. Let's assume that we know how to interpret the velocities as a function of density and compute the geoid. Okay, including all the self-gravitation effects that are important at low wavelengths. And because of that, let's try to invert for the viscosity structure that best fits the geoid. Okay, and you know, we've done that several times. Most recently, people have also used postglacial rebound, which I'm not going to talk about, joint inversions of postglacial rebound data and the geoid. And you know, say Alex Forte and Jerry Mitrovica, they've come up with a viscosity structure that looks like this. Okay, now. How the geoid behaves is going to be, you know, extremely critical to understand where that dynamic topography is developing. Is it really at the surface, or is it really hiding at some boundary in the interior? You know, again, topography generated on the core mantle boundary is going to be important to take that into account. But any sort of boundary in the interior will actually also have to be explored. And there's also, you know, topography at 410 and 660. The bottom line is that if you do sort of modeling of the geoid, you find, so this is one example using the flat model, you find that there is a best fitting viscosity structure. But the robustness of that viscosity structure is very limited because, you know, you can show theoretically that there's a complete trade-off between the thickness of the layer and the viscosity of the layer. So you can hide, you know, huge amounts of viscosity that is low or viscosity that is very high in a very thin layer, and the geoid or postglacial rebound would know no better. So really all you can constrain as far as, okay, so this is indoctrination, but it doesn't matter. But all you can constrain in terms of the viscosity structure of the Earth from the geoid is the fact that the lower mantle is likely 30 to 100 times more viscous than the upper mantle. And anything else is really subject to how you parameterize and, you know, being willing to accept very tiny, tiny differences in the correlation coefficients between your predicted and your observed geoid. Okay, now, yes, sir. Well, you can't tell that, but there's another thing, is that you can show that if you have a thin layer with a very low viscosity, you compare it with a thin layer with very high viscosity, and you know, it would You know, so you can have viscosity structures that vary dramatically, and it doesn't care any less. Because if you make it very thin, you could make it inviscid as water, and the GOA would never see it. You can put some constraints on that. You might not be able to say within 100, 200, 300 kilometers, but you can tell that broadly, you know, the upper mantle has to be less viscous as a whole and the lower mantle is viscous. You know, whether it transitions over 500 kilometers, it's very hard to tell. And within the context of the simple instantaneous flow modeling, actually not possible. Okay, so let me end up with this, and I've taken a lot longer than I expected. And that is that let's sort of go back full circle to the issue of plates and slab and the strengths of slabs and look at geoid and topography over subduction zones. So we've known for a long time that geoid maxima over subduction zones between degrees 4 and 9, supraharmonic degree 4 and 9, you know, are related, so they're geoid highs over subduction zones, okay? And there's also a geoid maxima in the back arc at degrees greater than 9. And this is a bandpass filter view of the geoid, long wavelength view of the geoid. You can see the highs right here. This is at shorter wavelengths, and this is a blow up of that, where you can see that there are some geoid highs right here in the back arc and here in this region here. Okay. So one of the things that we've seen, with modeling in the last few years, or say 10 years or so, is that to explain the opposite of what you expect as subduction zones, you need a large viscosity increase at 660 kilometer depth. Then does not go away even when you account for the effect of phase transition. Okay. If you actually look at shorter wavelengths such as this, you see a very interesting picture, and this is the work of Louis Moresi and Mike Gernes, and Magali Billen and Mike Gernes. You see two things. First, I'm going to try to describe this. This is the observed geoid. This is that area. This is Japan right here. So it's really a sort of a close-up of that area that I did a close-up before. And this is the geoid profile, the observed geoid profile, and here's the long wavelength filtered version. And it's this long wavelength filter version that is going to be compared here in these five models of three-dimensional models of flow, where they're actually varying the relative viscosity of the slab compared to the upper mantle. And what did they find? Which is very interesting. They found that, in fact, the slabs, that the lower mantle was about 60 to 200 times more viscous than the upper mantle. That the slabs, you know, had to be in contact with the lower mantle. And that, in fact, in this model right here, which is the one that fits the best, or one of these, you actually have a very weak slab compared to the upper mantle. From which they infer that the short wavelength geoid observations and the topographic observations sort of implied that the viscosity structure was such that slabs were actually weak and not able to guide any stresses. And obviously, this was going to be, you know, critically related to that. And then later on, Magali Billing also looking at geoid and topography, and what is plotted here is the topography as a function of longitude. They were looking at Tonga. They found that, in fact, they needed to explain the very short wavelength topography observations and geoid observations near Tonga. They needed a low viscosity zone right above the slab. And this is shown right here. So this is sort of the standard model right here, which does not have a low viscosity zone. And you see there is a very broad topographic signal right here. When in fact they included a low viscosity region, whether it was deep or shallow, they got something that is a lot closer to observations, which is actually not plotted here, where you get a much sharper, much shorter wavelength topographic signal right there. So that there's a lot to be learned from the surface observations and the combination of the surface observations for understanding the viscosity structure and how slabs behave in connection to the mantle. So I'll stop there, and then I guess we'll have to go to lunch soon. But okay, that's it. Questions? Yes, sir.